This tape contains a story of Jan Swalzeen, taken at the Tananaw Yukon Historical Society, of his early life in Alaska, and also a little short talk by Clara Rustin, another one of the original pioneer women of the early days here at Fairbanks, Alaska.
Gents, I'd like to introduce Jens Welsine, who is going to speak to us tonight about his life and the years he has spent in and around the Fairbanks area particularly, and possibly some additional areas that he has visited during his 50 years, Jens?
53 years.
53 years in Alaska. This is Jens Welsine. What prompted you to come to Alaska, Jens?
Well, that's a kind of a long story. I was streetcarring in Seattle. The wages were low. Started with 25 cents an hour. And we worked the all kinds of hours. We used to get up at 4:30 in the morning. Maybe work out at 1:30 in the morning. Back on shift again at 4:30 in the morning. Put in sometimes 20 hours a day out of 24 hours. 180 shifts straight without a layoff. So I got tired of that. So I made up my mind I'd come north, see if I can get in better wages. So I met a fellow there that had been up to Slate Creek and worked in 1909, and he was going to go back after first of the year. And I made my mind right there and then. I said, I'm with you. So after first of the year, we kept contact. So the first day I thought you were ever sailed for Valdez. Took us 8 days to make the trip. And we had figured to get a lay on a piece of ground from a woman there at Valdez over in Slate Creek country. And by that time, she had already left it to another party. So then we had nothing to do at that time, and we couldn't afford to stop in a hotel, eat at the restaurant, so we rented the cabin and went patching. And we stayed there for 3 weeks. And so we decided then to go to work for a grain copper mine. That's 12 miles cross country from the Kennecott mine. And that's 165 miles out of Valdez. So there was 20 men started on that trip. And most of us wasn't used to walking, and it was tough going. No trail. And we got as far as Tonsina. And most of us, our feet were swelled. So somebody said, well, the best thing for that is to take off your socks and shoes, run around the roadhouse two or three times, 35 below zero. So we did. And, half a dozen of us could think that we were crazy. So, Jake Neff, that I knew later on, he was on the roadhouse at the time. We used to talk about it, the idea of running around in that kind of a weather. Anyhow, we got into Chitna, and stopped at the roadhouse there overnight, and we had 25 miles to make into the prospector's cabin, and all we got to make that 25 miles on was one sandwich. And when we got there, we got there pretty early in the afternoon, and there was a recall on our bedding, and I knew there wasn't much grub on the load. So I looked around and I found a lot of bale beans, and I looked around for a big pot, and the only thing to boil it on was on a big feeding stove. Somebody said, "What are you going to do?" And I told him. Oh, he said, "You're crazy." Well, I said, "I ain't the first time I was crazy." I said, "I know they must grub on that rig." And I said, "I'm a young man and I got good appetite." So I cooked a pot of beans. Well, there wasn't much left that night with the beans. I wasn't so crazy after all. Then we had 12 miles to make the next day. So we finished up the beans, bacon, and a little bread. And when I got up to the mine there, that was the last 4 miles was a steady uphill climb. So I stayed there a while and I looked at these fellows, you know, and they were sickly looking, poor air in the mine. So 3 of us decided that there was no place to spend a life. And this foreman, he wanted me to stay and learn me to run a machine. I told him, I said, there wasn't enough money in this mountain, I says, to pay for my health. I said, I'm going to leave while I'm able to get out. So we started off at Chitna. When we got to Chitna, two of them went to Fairbanks. And I went down on the Copper River River and worked there at tea kettle. And there the conditions was awfully poor. We had all tents. 380 men slept in one tent, 4 bunks high, and stood up on posts. There was 2 feet of water. And they laid planks in between the bunks. That's the only floor they had. The rest was all open. And I got a bad cold, and the grub they had down there, and I was sick most of the time. So I worked there and stayed there until the middle of June. And I used to go over to the hospital there and visit with a man nurse in the evenings, spend the evening. So on the 11th of June, he told me, he said, if you want to live any longer, he said, you get on ahead while you're able to walk. Well, I said, I figured I'd go to Cordova for a rest. He said, I don't care where you go, as long as you get out of here. So he gave me a bottle of medicine for my cold. And next evening, we were on the trail for Fairbanks. And between this bottle of medicine and get out in the fresh air, and we packed a certain amount of grub with us and stopped at the roadhouse during the day, and we walked at nights, all daylight. And by the time I got into Fairbanks, I was rid of my coal and I felt good. And we had so many glacier streams to cross in the rain. Those 3 days we didn't have a dry stitch, day or night. And we made that trip in 11 days, 365 miles. And then we got into Fairbanks here, and then we decided to go out on the Quicksilver for work. We didn't even know the Tanana Valley Railroad. We'd take us out, we'd walk out to Fox, and up Pedro, and then over the hill into Holness. I went to work for Walter Fisher. And I worked there for a while, for about 2 weeks. And I quit there, I was working in the tailings. And somebody said, "Why are you quitting for it?" Well, I said, I wore out 2 pair of rubber boots in 2 weeks, running up and down these boxes. And I said, "It don't pay me to work here." So I went over to Hutch Williams, on Goldstream, and worked there, and later on finished up on Pedro.
Pardon me, Jens, this was what year now?
This was in 1910. And then we took a lady from Julius Guys and worked that winter. And the pay didn't look very good to me. And every time I said, "Well, it don't look good," no, I said, "It goes $1.25, $1.50 a foot." Well, I said, "I don't think it even goes 6 bits per foot." Well, they said, you don't know anything about mining. I said, no, I don't. But I said, I still don't think it's going to go 6 feet. I said, if it does, I'll be glad. Clean up in the spring and win 40 cents to the foot. Paid up 25% royalty. They come up for $200 apiece in the spring after 8 months of hard work. And I left Pedro then and went over to Alvarado. I ran into some on the hard lot. I worked for Jack McMahon. He went broke. I lost $140. And I didn't see a check then until then I went to work for Billy Burns before I seen the first check in August. So then in 1915, I had a chance to buy the store to El Alvarado. So I told his party, I said, I guess he wants too much for it. Oh no, he said, I guess you get it pretty reasonable. So I bought the store for $375. A building 22x36, two-story building. So I was in the store business, and then I worked in the mines. I followed underground mining for 7 years, and I was foreman for Hans Hess the last year that I worked for him in 1915. Then in 1916, I went into Thiemann business. And then later on, I went up to Chattanooga and worked for the FE company. And I was in Palmer mining, and I had a store down at Chattanooga for a number of years. And then I worked on the dredges for about 11 years at Chattanooga. And I landed over in Fairmont Street and started a store over there in 1938. And they sold the store out in 1952 and went out of business. And I went outside for a trip. And we were to live there in Palo Alto. See, my brother come up here in 49, and it's the first time I'd seen him since 1908. And the only one I've seen of our family since 1908. And he said, why not make a trip to the States? He said, so in 51, I made a trip out there, my first trip out in 41 years. And we bought a place down in Palo Alto there. Later on, and I come back then in the spring of 51, and then in 52 I sold out the store at Fairmont Street, and we went out to live. We bought a place in Palo Alto, and we lived there for about a year, and then my wife said, what do you say we sell out and go back to Alaska? I said, all right. So we couldn't sell, so I turned the home over to my brother, and came back to Alaska in the spring of 54. Then I went out again in 1960. And then I was in this last summer again, and I went out and came back this spring.
Where was your store on the Eldorado located? The lower end of the creek?
Yeah, it's on the lower end.
Down near the railroad?
Right at the railroad track.
What was the picture in 1910 when you went out to Gold Stream and Eldorado and Stone Creek? Were there, as I understood it, there were quite a number of people on all those creeks?
Oh, yes, there were a lot of people there. Even Little Eldorado was over 200 people on Little Eldorado at the time I was there. And homeless. They had quite a bunch there at homeless. Chattanooga was a big crowd. No trouble seeing 300-400 men there in the evenings. Down there playing pool there at Pitts. Ring of Pricks, as we used to call them. They had a store there at Chattanooga and pool table. Oh, there was a lot of men up and down the creek there. A lot going on them days.
Where did Sam Wise come from?
He came from Pennsylvania.
Did he settle in the Chattanooga area always?
Well, he settled there. He was in Clary for a while, and then later on in Chattanooga, lived there for years in Chattanooga. He was a commissioner for a number of years in Chattanooga. and he died in 33 in Seattle.
Do you remember the Arctic Brotherhood?
Oh, the A.B. Hall?
Yeah.
Oh, and that story, yeah.
I remember I helped tear it down, but...
Yeah, the A.B. Hall, they call the Arctic Brotherhood. Yeah, man. They had that going there pretty good at that time. And Nordale, he had a hotel there in Clary. And Alfred Gessie, and he had a store there in Chattanooga for a good many years. And Paul Ringsett, he had a store, him and Johnny Metzger. And Paul Ringsett, he died in Seattle this last winter, this last spring before come up. Jack Dalton, I visited her in Seattle this last winter. Jack Nelson died in 53. So, practically all the old timers, I guess I was the last old timer at Chattanooga. I was in the whole bunch. Practically all of them dead and gone.
Jack Dalton, any
kin
of this Jim Dalton?
No relation whatsoever. Jack Dalton was Mrs. Bill O'Leary's brother. Is Jack Dalton that I'm talking about.
What year was you married?
Me? I was married here at the Nordale Hotel on the 15th of June, 1912. That is when you didn't have to have a marriage license. It was cheaper to come in here to get married than to stay outside and pay the license. I won the best cigar in Fairbanks on that. Schenkel, like, used to have the laundry. He come in on the same boat as my wife come in on the 14th of June. He said, "Have you got your marriage license?" I'd already found out. And I said, "Who in the world heard of a marriage license in Alaska?" I said, "This is a free country." I said, "They don't charge for anything here. Everything is free." Oh, I said, "Well, let them tell you that." Well, I says, "I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll bet you the best cigar in Fairbanks. I don't have to have it." They said, "All right." We went over to the courthouse. Said, "This young man wants to get married and he's trying to tell me he don't need a marriage license." "No," I said, "we don't give out any papers." He said, "Get out of here. If you want to get married, go ahead and get married. Get it over with." And Schenkel said, "That's one on me." Well, I got a 50-cent cigar anyway. Out of that.
Okay.
And the funny thing happened this summer. A fellow by the name of Larson. He used to mine on Fairbanks Creek. Freeman and Larson. And I met him there at Redmond, Washington last winter. I was waiting for the bus. And happened to be nasty weather. So he said, "Kind of miserable today." Well, I said, "I'm used to it." I said, "No, well, I'm colder than this." And he says, "Where from?" And I told him, "Fairbanks, Alaska." Well, he said, "I left there in 1914. And by that time, I said, "You were partner Freeman." And he said, "Yes." By that time, the bus pulled in, and I didn't get his address, and he didn't get mine. So on the 18th of July, what's his golden winning anniversary. And I come in there, they were going to have that parade that day, and I come into the Nordale, and I was standing there at the desk. The fellow stepped up and threw the key down, and he said, "Are you the man I'm supposed to see?" And I says, "I don't know, it depends on who you're looking for." Well, he said, "Yeah, didn't I see you in Redmond?" He said, "At the bus." Well, I said, "Mr. Larson." He said, "Yeah." So then his wife come along and he said, "This is what I've been living with for the last 50 years. And he introduced his wife. So he said, "Well, we come up here to celebrate the Golden Wedding." He said, "We got married in the old Nordale Hotel on July 18th. 1912. Well, I said, you haven't got the best of me. I said, I beat you by a month. He said, I got married on the 15th of June. Well, that was kind of a surprise.
Getting back to your wedding, you had to file some sort of a paper with the court, didn't you?
No,
who married you?
No.
The judge?
Well, we had a minister.
A minister.
Yeah.
And he probably filed it or made some record somewhere.
No, I don't know whether he did or not.
You don't think there's any record of your marriage in the court?
I don't know. We got married at the Nordell Hotel and we had a minister and that's all I know. So anyway, Larson got married too. He didn't have to have any Larson. And then didn't have any license until 1916 before they got a license and marriage license.
What's the name of the minister?
Oh, I forget the name. There was another couple that got married the same night as we did. I forget his name. You know, it's pretty hard to remember so many years ago.
Where were you born?
I was born at Donnelly, Minnesota. That's 9 miles north of Morris, Minnesota, in the Middle West. And on December 6th, 1883.
Your parents are your Norwegian descent.
A Norwegian descent. Got a German name. Got a family tree from 1709. Dated back, clear back to 1709. The fellow come from Germany and went to Norway and went to school and got married there in Norway. 1709. I left there in 1905, went to North Dakota, landed in Spokane in the fall of 1905. I stayed around Spokane, Washington for a year. I worked out at Alec, Washington in the woods for a while, cut the woods with a party that I knew from back home there in Minnesota. And I went to Milken, at the Dairy Ranch, the Hazelwood Dairy Ranch out of Spokane. And I stayed there for about a month and a half during the winter. There was no other work. Milking 25 cows for a dollar a day. And we got up at 5 o'clock in the morning. Three of us had to feed 150 head of cattle. Breakfast at 6. 6:30 we're milking. 9 o'clock we're through milking. Then one would wash that and run the milk through coolers and strainers. Two of us cleaned the barn. And we had to work just like piece work. By 12 o'clock we had the barn cleaned up and the cows turned in. 12 o'clock we had lunch. 12:30 we're out curing the cows and feeding them bay calf. 2:30, we had that to ourselves until 5 o'clock in the evening. Then we had 150 head of cattle to eat. 6 o'clock, we had dinner. 6:30, we're back milking. And by 10 o'clock, we had everything cleaned up, went to bed for a dollar a day. And so I finally stayed there about a month and a half, and I had an awfully tough string of cows to milk. And somebody said, you must have been broke. Because they have from 18 to 20 milkers on that string a year. Well, I said, they'll have a few more after I leave. So when I said, well, you're foolish leaving now, and you get $40 a month during the summer, all you have to do is do the milking. I said, no, I said, I'm through milking. I said, I'm through farming from now on. So I left there. Then I went to work for another farmer there during the spring work. When I got through there, I went to Hollis Brickyard, 4 miles out of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And I worked down towards fall and went down to Pendleton, Oregon, loading some electric machinery. Then we went back to Harrington, Washington, and I was acquainted with a fellow there. We lived in Farsham. He was the engineer and I was the fireman. We followed the trash machine. And we left Spokane in the fall of 1906. We landed in Ballard. Then I went to work for the Colfax Pierce Company. Put in 5 months there, and somebody said, why not leave the Pierce alone? Go streetcar. Well, I said, all right. So I went in, hired out streetcar company. I broke in on 7 different lines in 6 weeks, in 6 days, and then sent me out on the first line of the night, all alone over the first line, but I got through all right. So I spent 2 years with a streetcar.
How did the drift pick and shovel line work in the drift compare with the Milton job you had?
Well, that was tougher than Milton.
Do you think that a man has ever devised a job that compares with pick and shovel in the drift?
Well, the trouble was them days, you see, a man stood over you all day. If you didn't put out, why then, you went on top and another man take your place.
Now, can you tell him something about pick and shovel and drift work?
Well, it's just, you tore your ground, and you drive either 10-foot points, 8-foot points, or 10-foot points, or 12-foot points. You're steaming so long, until about, you've got about 4 feet height. You've got to be stooped over all day. And you've got to follow the leader. The leader used to be paid 4 bits more a day than the rest of them. And you have to follow the leader. If you didn't, why, you couldn't throw your wheelbarrow aside. If you did, you went on top. Somebody else take your place.
And that usually averaged about 100 wheelbarrows a shift.
Yeah, you'd average around 100. It depends on the ground, too. Sometimes maybe 120 wheelbarrows a shift. Figure around 12 wheelbarrows an hour, 10 hours. And believe me, you didn't run around the evenings when you got through the work. Why, you'd go to bed and lay down. You'd be all in by that time. I worked there for Walter Fisher. As I said, I wore out 2 pair of rubber boots there, working in the tailing. The last half day I worked, why, they sent another man to help me. It was getting pretty tough. From the mine, and he stayed with me only a little while, and he said it's too much. I said, too much for 2 of us, and here I've been alone. He went down to send another fellow up. He stayed a little while, and he said it's too much. He goes down. He sent the third fellow up. Well, he finished the day with me. That's the time I got wise, so the next morning I quit. And then they wanted this other fellow to take the place that stayed with me, and he said, no, he said, if Jens can't stand it, he said, I can't. He said, if it's too much for him, it's surely too much for me. Oh, that was, they talk about slavery, but the slavery wasn't in it, compared to.
What wages did you get then, Jens?
What? Wages?
Yeah.
$5 a day and board.
$5 the last time.
Yeah.
Weren't they proposing, and didn't they carry out to some extent the proposal of shipping in a bunch of Russians here at one time to work for a little less?
Well, the men wanted, they had a strike here in 1907 or 8. They had a strike. They were striking, the trouble was then they were striking for higher wages and lower hours. If they'd either struck for one or the other, they'd have got it, but they struck for the 2 at the same time, so they didn't get it. And then later on, well, they cut it down to 8 hours, and you got 4.5. And now if you're on 4 bits a day, so you got 4.5 a day for 8 hours work. And some of the Russians said, well, they said, we're losing money, we ain't making. They said, we're going to make 4.5. Well, they said, you ain't earning it. Comparing it to $5 a day in 10 hours. It was better to work for 8 hours, 4.5 and 8 hours, than to work for 10 hours for $5. You work 2 hours more for 50 cents. and they couldn't see it that way. And I told them, I said, it was better to get the hours down, and someday, I said, the wages may really equalize itself, which it did. But they couldn't see it that way, though. They thought they were losing 4 bits a day. I said, you ain't earning it. So you ain't losing.
Did they pay less in the wintertime underground in a year?
Well, they did in places, not like Bigelow out there at Fox. He paid them, I think it was $3.5 to $4 a day for 10 hours work, because there was no other work to be had, and lots of fellows would rather work than to lay around doing nothing and paying out money and not making anything. So, but there wasn't very many of them. Bigelow was the only one that I knew of that done it.
Normally, the regular winter wages are 3.5 to 6 bits a day for 8 hours on the ground.
I was working there for Teddy Rain, an old Larson there on El Dorado. That was my last year. It was in 1916. My last year I worked in the mine. Teddy put me to work under a slab that was 2 feet thick, and I didn't know at the time that they had tried to blast it down the night before. And so I, there was a Russian right in front of me, and it was low. It was only about this high. Down on my knees picking and shoveling, and there was a sandy roof, and they spit a little sand on my hat. Well, I figured it was the heat of the candle that made it. Still, I knew the slab was hanging above me. So I'd go out and look at it, and it didn't look like it had opened up. It was up about this much, about 2 inches. I'd go back and work a little more, and sand spitting a little more, and I was kind of leery of it. Well, the last time I looked at it, I said, well, I'll put a rock in there, and I put a rock in there just to fit it. And I went back and worked a little while, and finally went out and looked at it, and I could see that move just a little. So I told the Russian, I said, get your wheelbarrow away so I can run mine out. I was foolish enough to get my shovel and pick and can stick out of there. And I looked at this slab in less than a minute. Down comes the slab, 15 feet long and 6 feet wide and 2 feet thick. And the Russian says to me, he said, you're a smart man. He said, you savvy. Well, I said, I come for an out savvy that time. Come to find out, I told Dad about it. Well, I said, I tried to blast it on the night before. Well, I said, out of knowing that, I said, you never got me to work on it. I was that close to even killing the mine. I said, well, this is my last year in the mine. So I quit having the ground mine. And I went to work for the FDE. And I put in 30 years, I guess, right to the day, the FDE. All told.
Were there many men killed?
Well, they were in the same drift that I worked. There was a Russian that killed with a slap. There was another one got killed up at Clary for Fred Schout. He worked for Fred Schout. A fellow by the name of Erickson that I knew got killed there. I helped get that body out.
That's one in Nine Below.
You mean at Clary?
Yeah.
No,
well, the Nine Below, they never did find.
No, this was down where the Y of the switch of the railroad. Fed Shop was mining some ground there, pretty close to there. And, he got, killed in there. And there was one that drowned, I believe, over on Dome. I take it all told, I don't think there was over 4 or 5 that I remember that got killed in the mine. They were pretty lucky at that. For the chances they were taking. I worked with Henry Hamilton, 1911. Fall of 1911. That ground was awfully treacherous. We had the boat hit every other tall. And these small slabs. Well, there was two that killed up on 9 below, as you were talking about. Foster and Hungerford. Mark Burns, Billy Burns, his brother, and down near Sackerson. Slab and killed Mark outright. Andy lived about 2 hours. That was a brother, Billy Burns, that used to mine there. Yeah, he bought their ground later on there, down the way to Amistown. Yeah, I forgot about those two. And then there was one that drowned up there someplace. One of those mines. We went down the door.
Well, drift mining wasn't particularly hazardous, as mining goes. Is that your impression?
What?
I say drift mining wasn't particularly hazardous as mining goes.
In other
words, not as hazardous as hard rock mines where they're blasting and...
Oh, no. It's, as far as, you know, you never get the miner's consumption working in what they call the placer mine. The quartz mining is you get that dust on your lungs. That's the reason I left Gray's copper mine. On account of that dust. And these fellows, you know, sickly looking. I made my mind I was too young a man to lose my health. So, I got out of there, and I never went back in another quartz mine.
Yes, can you describe to us the layout of a typical underground platinum mine? How they laid it out?
Well, you mean how you're opening it up?
Mm-hmm.
Well, whenever you sink a shaft, whether you got pay or not pay, if you either one way or the other, you'd put in cross cuts from your shaft across the creek, not up and downstream, but you put it across the creek. Find out, if you haven't got the pay, to find out which side of the shaft there is pay. Or if you have pay, to find out how far it extends. And just what you call it, more or less a prospect pump. Then after you find out that you've got your pay and where it extends, then you drive your tunnels up and down the street. And you go as far up stream as you want, or as far downstream, whether you want to go 150 feet or 200 feet each way from the shaft. Then you put in your crosscuts then on both sides of your main tunnel. Then you work back towards the shaft, upstream and downstream. That's really the proper way. I had an argument with Matt Steiners on that. He said, well, he said, yeah, you drive tunnel this way, you drive tunnel this way and that way. He said, you drive upstream and downstream. I said, no. I said, not prospecting. You wouldn't drive up and downstream. I said, because you're cross-cut to find out where your pay is. I said, it'd be natural. I said, if you had no pay and you're on up and downstream, I said, you wouldn't have no pay either one end or the other. I said, you'd have to find pay first, and naturally you'd have to cross the creek. And he couldn't see that. I told him, I said, all the mines I work, you know, I said, they always put in cross cuts. I said, to find out if they've got pay or they haven't got pay, they'll drive cross cuts. And after they locate and everything, they'll drive up and downstream their main tunnel. Some of them use cars, and up in the tunnel, some run clear to the shaft with wheelbarrows. Well, I worked there for Walter Fisher, and the second I worked for him in 1912, he had cars in the face because the pay was wide there, 500-600 feet either way you look. They had cars in the face to vent to a car. And they had so many cars, and they had two men running the cars in and out. And they had hoist as high as 500 buckets a day, 50 buckets an hour, out of 180 feet per shift. And that is all right if you have a good partner, but if you get a bum partner, you got to do all the shoveling. So I quit there. Herman Boone was foreman there, and I told him I was going to quit, and he said, why? Well, I said, I got a bum partner, I got to do all the shoveling. I said, I'm going to go a place where they got a wheelbarrow. I said, I shall Phil Nolan wheelbarrow. But I said, Phil, the other fellow's wheelbarrow too. I said, wouldn't do. So that's the time I quit work the second time. I didn't feel like doing all the work. And the other fellow getting his share in the money. And then, as you say, when you drive points, some use cold water, driving points, and some use steam. But the best way is to use water, because it don't slop so much. Steamy as you slop so much.
The idea being that you're just taking off 3 or 4 feet on bedrock underneath.
Well, it depends, you see. If your gravel is loose, it pays on bedrock and in bedrock. Sometimes if the gravel is tight and there's cinnamon on it, why, then it's paying the gravel. If they're going to take, about a foot and a half or something like that of bedrock and the rest of gravel. But they don't take any more than what really they have to. That's the reason that they put in a lot of these low taws. It's hard on a working man, but it's the man that runs the mine, the cheaper one. It takes less steam and less dirt.
Yeah. When did they start cold water thawing
here?
What? When did they start doing cold water here?
Well, you mean in the mine?
Yeah.
Well, what I call cold water, they use pumps, but it's fairly warm. It's not what you call really cold either. You had a pump, you see, and return the water. You had a sump hole out there by the shaft to one side, and you return the water. And of course, when you get too much water, as you tow the ground, and then you siphon water out to the top. You always had a certain amount of water, so that the water wasn't what was called cold. But it was better driving that way, and then in place of driving only one point, you'd have maybe 4 or 5 points, and you go from one to the other, and driving them. It gives a chance to thaw the ground. I don't forget the first night I went to work there for Walter Fisher the first time.
What creek was this on, Jim?
That was on Niggerhead Flats.
Oh, or El Dorado?
No, down the Dome. That was down the Dome.
Dome?
Yeah, Dome and below Owners, down the Niggerhead Flats. And so the fellow wanted to take a day off, so I went down to help the point driver and drive points that night, and I wasn't used to the single jack, and I drove 10 footers, that's 100 feet. And that night, the boss come down, and he said, how's that young fella doing? Oh, he's fine, he's gonna be a good point driver. I said, not for me. My wrist got so sore, I couldn't hold the hammer handle anymore. I had to tie a handkerchief around my wrist, around the hammer handle to take the weight off. And I said, no point driving for me. I was all in that morning. And then in 1911, when I went over to El Dorado, then they wanted me to drive points over there, and I didn't want to drive points. Said, there'll be two of you. You can double up on them. One turn the point, the other one drive. So then I went driving points. So I drove points on and off, sometimes over the weekend.
He works for the City Light and Power Company in Seattle.
He's been with them now for about 15, 20 years. Yeah, I wanted to go off the band, but turned out to be all boys. My wife said once, she said, what you haven't got, you don't miss. Well, I just remember that when you want a new dress. So there's one way of getting back at him.
Was your wife a Norwegian descent too,
Jim? No, she was Swedish descent. She was born in McKeesport, Pennsylvania. She lived in Seattle, remote Seattle, when she was a young girl. She died in 59 on the 4th of December with cancer.
Well, I don't know if anything more to ask you, Jen.
No, I guess I'm just about.
Are you getting tired or?
No, me, I could talk all night.
You sure enjoy it. You ready for sale?
What?
I'm asking, Jen, in Keesport, what year was that around here in Keesport? 1450?
What
I was in McKeesport in 1914, 15, 6 years.
In McKeesport?
Yeah.
Oh, no, she was, her folks moved to Seattle about 1901 or 1902 in Seattle.
You know what else thought you said the little paper running down Cherry Creek?
What?
Mr. Smith, do you remember?
Oh, yeah, Bob Smith, yeah. I knew Bob Smith.
Yeah. Democrats,
when
he
sold
a
claim
to the
FD,
he
got
on,
I mean,
he was a socialist,
he
sold a claim to the FD,
he got
a lot of money, and he turned
to a Democrat. Oh, yeah. And Roy Lund used to have a paper up Kegel Creek. When I was mining up there. And I used to get a bunch of mail from my sweetheart at that time. And he said, don't you ever call for your mail? I said, yes, well, they don't look like it. He said, a bunch of it. He said, don't they give it to you? I said, I guess they do. He thought, you know, I didn't give them the mail. I was getting so much mail all the time. But there were two stretches, there were 9 months that I didn't get my mail. The mail was behind for 9 months. One trip I had going clear down to St. Michael's, one trip. Mail that was addressed to Chattanooga. Went clear down to St. Michael's. And I had the mail laid in Cordova for 9 months. Christmas mail I got in next September. So I got so used to not getting mail regularly. So up there at Chattanooga, my wife would always go and get the mail, worrying about the mail. Well, I was working and busy, and lots of times letters had been laying there for 3 days. I wouldn't even open them. I wouldn't have time to open the letter. Trying to get tired of looking at them, and she says, I'll open them and read them for you.
Did they establish a small local post office on each one of those creeks in the early days?
Well, Alorado at the time I was there, and they didn't have any post office. We got our mail to Chattanooga. And then if there was a bundle or something like that, it was arranged here with, what was his name? Deal. Made arrangement with Deal whenever there was a package in place of someone to clear to Chattanooga. I sent it on the train and they'd drop it off at Alameda for me. In place to go up there for 2 miles and pack it. But they had a post office at Clary, Chattanooga, and Owens. I don't even remember they had one there at Alameda anytime.
And a bank or two at each one of those towns?
Oh, yeah, they had a bank at Clary. They had a bank at Chattanooga there. That's where I had my store. That used to be a bank, and later on it was a jail. And then another party lived in there, and then I bought the place and had a store on it. But they had no bank in Omaha. They had one at Dome. I guess, Jesse Noble. I guess he was interested in that bank there at Dome City.
Well, they weren't affiliated from the Fairbanks Bank. They were privately owned banks.
Yeah, privately owned banks.
Was there a grand hotel in Dome? I remember seeing the sign, when Dome stopped at the Grand Hotel. I sure loved that sign.
No, Mr. Grand.
Well, I guess there was a hotel there years ago at Dome. A good many years ago. And there at El Dorado, they had a kind of a lodging house there, but they didn't have what they call a hotel.
Did Mrs. Scope settle on Clary originally and always stay there?
Yeah, Mrs. Scope?
Yeah.
Yeah, she did, yeah.
Did you know Clary is joint?
Jocelyn? Yeah. Charlie Jocelyn's manager?
Agent?
Yeah, we were just talking about a slow train. I told him, I said, I've seen the slowest train in the world. You wouldn't know where I've seen it. And I said, I'm down on the Copper River Railroad. I said, how long do you think it took them to make 101 miles out of Cordova to Tequito? Well, nobody could guess. Well, I said, it took them exactly 60 days of this to make the trip. I said, they left off 215. Railroad men out this boat Yucatan that I come up on, and they had a lot of meat to go to on the Copper River Railroad. I stayed in Valdez. I walked into Copper Mountain, stayed there, and walked back and down to Tequito. I shoveled snow there when it was 18 feet on the level, and they had snow slides one after the other, and I got there long before the meat got there. By that time, it was just black as days of faith. I've been dragging it here and dragging it there. And actually, I see meat come on the table there with a hair and height on. And they showed the dishes. They had a great big box. They showed the dishes in, a sink, as they call it, but it was more like a sluice box. So there were dishes in there, and maybe the water was hot when they threw it in there, and the water was cold when they took them out. And sit down to the table, you have to take bread or biscuit and wet the plates off. That soap and grease, and that's what put me on the bum. With the cold I had, if I start coughing, I cough out everything I had. That's the reason I was ordered out of it. Between the sleeping quarters and the way they fed the men down there was enough to kill anybody. And they fed from 600 to 1,000 men.
How were they getting their copper ore off?
Well, they built the road. That's what they built the road for.
Oh, before the
Hancock. Yeah, you see, the road was only 101 miles out of Cordova in 1910. And it was 198 miles to Kennecott Mine. So that's the reason I built the railroad, was to get the copper on, more of it. I didn't get any off before I got the railroad in. That was in 1910.
So it was actually the Kennecott copper deposit that you were working in, the original town.
Oh, yeah. That's what I say. So you see, that's what the railroad was built for. J.M. Heaney was the one that built the railroad for the company. Some company, what they call the Copper River.
Anybody got any more questions?
Have you got any questions? You were here at that time?
No. Well, how many, and they had the school at Clary, how many children went there?
Or Clary?
Well, what year?
What year? Like 1905?
Well, there wasn't very many children, because there wasn't very many children here in Fairbanks. Children was as rare then as mosquitoes in the wintertime.
When did they start their first school here?
Well, I don't remember when we started the first school here. There wasn't very much. There wasn't very many going to school here at that time. I guess Frank Young was one of them. And Arnold Nordale and Yelmer Nordale, they were going to school here them days.
They had no school out on the creek, though, Clary, at that time, 1910.
Well, yes, it is. Not at Clary, but they did attend. Not at Clary. They didn't have a school at Clary that I remember. I didn't see the school at Clary, not at Chattanooga. In that school. And I was on the school board there for 6 years at Kevin. And I was there.
I asked that question, I talked to the Nordale boys and I thought they told me they had the school at the Clearly, they came to Fairbanks on 1907.
Yeah.
But they must have went to school at Chattanooga then.
They must have, because I don't remember.
There was a school there in 1907 when I was on down Clary in Chattanooga.
Upper Clary?
Yeah.
Upper end.
And the Nordale boys were going to school at that time.
I never seen the school, but they might have had a school as a trade. They might have had it, but I never did see a school myself. And there couldn't have been very many anyway going to school at that time.
Manley
did, yeah.
All the big miners were gone when Ken came. The earlier days, we had Tom Aiken and Tom McKinnon and Frank Manley and all of those. And the James boys.
Did you know Dave Luke, the miner at Chattanooga?
No, I didn't know him.
Did you know Frank Johnson? This is Frank Johnson who died last winter.
Yes, I know Frank Johnson very well.
Yeah, well, Mrs. Frank Johnson died last winter in Seattle. And Dave Luke died last fall in Renton. I went down to visit Miss Luke at Renton. She lives at 145 Park Street in Renton. And then I visited Miss Langsep, who used to cook for the Levick brothers at El Dorado. She lives only 7 blocks from where I live on Capitol Hill. Then I visited Miss Ferguson, that used to cook here for a number of years. She was in a rest home at Pomeroy and Myrtle Street, West Seattle. I didn't go to see Mrs. Burns last winter, but I seen Herb Miller and his wife up at Stevens Lake. Then I seen, what you call her, Mrs. Ernest Shermer. See, Ernest died last fall, and I met her at the Yukon Pioneer, the last meeting I was there. And then the Dutch kid's wife, she died last winter. Edith Neal, that was to her funeral. And John Kelly, that was to his funeral. And Mrs. Thomas, she stays down at Savoy. What? Well, that's all I mean. Put anything.
Well, they're going to wear you out yet.
What?
They're going to wear you out yet.
Oh, well, they got to do something to wear me out, even at my age.
Well,
he
really stood up good on
that 50 Dawson. Yeah, I forgot about the 50 Dawson. I wanted to see the Dawson, so I got Jerry took me to Dawson. And on our way back, we got to see Eagle. And if I was to live in Alaska, I think Eagle would be the place I'd live. It's a very nice place, but ain't very many there. But Dawson, too swampy. I don't like Dawson at all. It's all right to go there and see him. If I was living there, I don't think I'd live in Dawson. I was going to make a trip to Nome and cost to be on Point Barrow this summer, but I've been so busy that I didn't get away. I can wait another year, I guess. Wise has been after me to make that trip. Said if you don't make it, a snowball, so beat the tour. And I wasn't told her they're already beating the tour. I said I can give it up already.
Well, gents, you've given us a very interesting account of your life, and we certainly thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. I've done the best I could anyway.
Questioning Jens Walzine on the tape was Mr. Irving McKay Reed, Audrey Loftus, and Mr. Edby Davis.
Can you give us a few words? We'd like to have you here sometime. You're going to be here another month. I think I might be here.
Yes, we had here.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that might be kind of interesting. In the early days here, Fairbanks would have a big celebration on 4th of July, and they built a large bandstand about where the Chamber of Commerce building stands now. And they'd have the band there, and they shut off First Avenue, and just a dirt street, and the swing was all mud. So they shut off First Avenue, and they had races, nail driving contests, they even had horse races on that street. So the people from the Cricks wanted to come in. And the train would start out, it would leave, they had trains reversing. A train would leave Fairbanks at 8 in the morning and leave Chattanooga at 8 in the morning, and they'd pass at what we call the loop. And so we'd leave around out of Little El Dorado, leave El Dorado about, Chattanooga about 8 in the morning, get to El Dorado about 8:30, because they'd stop at every little camp and take on passengers. And there was so many coming in that they put on a couple flat cars. And they had benches on the flat cars, and the time that we get to Foxfly, they start filling up the flat cars, and imagine the women all in their finery, and we sit down these flat cars and parrots all over our heads, and all of our big skirts on, and all dolled up for very well, and we come into town for a couple of days for the 4th of July celebration, and the trains leave out there, as I say, at Chattanooga about 8 in the morning, we get into Fairbanks about 5:30 that night, if you can imagine that now, and they stop at every little town, pick people up. Fox, they always stopped for lunch, the train crew. We'd sit in the train, or we'd have our own lunch in a box, and we would, some that wanted to get off and go in and eat, but it was such a scramble for the train crew, and they didn't have accommodations to feed too many, so most of us took our lunch in the box and ate on the train. The crew would go and eat, and we'd sit in the train and wait until they'd come back on. They'd stop, and then they would bring engines at that time, and they'd stop and load on wood at different camps, and so that was really the slow train to Arkansas. We get in town about 5:30 that night. So that's an experience there. I thought something different than you have now, where you can drive out there in an hour, or less than an hour. And it took all day to go by train. And then in the wintertime, when we get out here, go up that steep hill behind Foxes, go up the Astoria Dome, they would have to switch up and down. They'd have an engine in each end of the train, and the snow would be deep, and they'd have to switch back and forth to work through. They'd have power on one of the engines, but it still, they couldn't get through the drift, so they would switch back and forth with an engine on each end of the train to get through those drifts. It's hard to believe that was the most interesting trip, going that little train, going up to Chattanooga, up to Fox and to Owens and all. And Jen's talking about Lou Eldorado brings back memories too, because that's where I wanted to ride. Lou Eldorado took me out there to ride. We left Fairbanks in the morning, and we got to a little above Fox, and we stayed the night there with some friends, with Judge Roy and his wife, and then the next day we went over the hill and down in Eldorado. So it took us that long to get to Chattanooga. We had no course and double ender.
That's not my honey. Sorry.
Mrs. Claire
Russ.
Yeah, you go ahead.
You go ahead, Jim. You go ahead. Yeah, Mrs. Claire Russ on a little story of her early life around Chattanooga and Fairbanks. It recorded at the Tamno Yukon Historical Society, and this is September the 27th, 1962 at Fairbanks, Alaska.